Thank you for giving me the chance to present my work here. It's a big pleasure. It's always fun to be back at Perimeter. So yeah, so language models for many-body physics. So so I guess everything starts with deep learning these days. So there's a lot of progress in the last 10 years related to using machine learning algorithms in many, many different fields, including computer vision, natural language processing, machine translation, self-driving cars, game playing, physics, chemistry, finance, and more. Mostly due to the availability of data sets, specialized hardware, and I think most importantly, algorithmic developments that have ushered a new generation of large models displaying unprecedented accuracy in all these tasks. So one example that's very popular is diffusion models. They produce impressive results that suggest that art as we know it will change. So one interesting example is this algorithm called DALL-E, which you prompt with a sentence in natural language, and then it draws some artistic picture. So it's very, very pretty. So here I have one example. So I prompted DALL-E with a monkey solving Maxwell equations in a blackboard in the style of Gustav Klimt. Okay, and this is what it produces. So definitely there's some aspects to related to the style, and the blackboard is there, and the equations and so on. So it's very, very interesting, and I think very impressive and exciting. So here is one more, a synth-pop portrait of the Perimeter Institute, okay? So it looks quite like Perimeter Institute in the colors of that style. So it's very exciting. One more about astronaut outside the Perimeter Institute. Okay, so this one looks pretty good in my opinion. Anyway, so that's very exciting, and these models do very surprising things. But I'm going to talk about natural language processing, which is this branch of computer science, linguistics, and machine learning concerned with giving computers the ability to process language in the form of text or spoken words in a similar way humans do. Their use of the NLP, natural language processing, is used for machine translation, speech recognition, sentiment analysis, summarization, and more. So ChatGPT, maybe everyone here has heard about it. It's a machine learning model which interacts in a conversational way. So this dialogue format makes it possible for ChatGPT to ask follow-up questions and admit mistakes and challenge premises and so on. And it's all over the news. So this new tool can replace human work. Users of ChatGPT writing a story about ChatGPT and more. So people believe these models will have a deep technological, educational, and societal implications. So ChatGPT can pass the United States medical licensing exam and the bar exam, which is for lawyers. And so they're very powerful. These models are crazy. This is from yesterday. So a science fiction magazine closed submissions because of being bombarded with stories written by ChatGPT. Okay, so they can write convincingly, although they're now being detected effectively. And so, yeah, so here's one example. I think you may have seen many of this. So write a very short story about the birth of quantum mechanics. So it writes coherent paragraphs and even sometimes factually correct. So it was a hot summer day in 19 when Max Planck, a German physicist, made a startling discovery and so on and so forth. So this text is very coherent over over quite a long amount of text, and I think this is very impressive. And these results are very, very striking. Sometimes it fails in very strange ways. So I asked ChatGPT to draw Mona Lisa using ASCII art, just using text to produce art. And this is the attempt. So sometimes it's not as great, but it's apologetic. Please note that this is a very simple and minimal representation of Mona Lisa, which is indeed true, but it tells you it's laughing, which is also a debate. Is Mona Lisa laughing at all or not. All right. So this is one more example. It's a model called Galactica. It's a large language model for science. It's the title of the paper, and you can read it in this archive link. So you prompt a scientific topic, and the language model writes a manuscript for you, okay, with surprising results. So here's one example. So this was from Ijaz, who is a grad student at Perimeter. So stochastic series expansion, which is a quantum Monte Carlo technique to solve many body problems, and it produces very almost correct, or actually even 100% correct description of what this technique is, and the references are, as far as I know, correct. Okay, so this is also very impressive, very interesting. However, so this was by Google, so Meta. So it shut down the public test of Galactica because it was producing pseudoscientific papers, okay, which is bad. So if you combine that with the idea that people can submit these papers to, say, journals or archive preprints and so on, so that makes sense, right? These models are dangerous, and we should be also careful about how we use them. And people have looked into this issue, and there's a very interesting paper on the dangers of stochastic parrots. So basically, these models are based on probabilistic models, and so that's why they use the word stochastic here. So they, first of all, they're unsustainable from the environmental perspective, so they have a huge carbon footprint. So this GPT model, the one behind the ChatGPT algorithm, has a very high electric bill. So people say or estimate that they use 27 million to train the model. So that's a lot of energy. It has a problem with lack of diversity in the data sets they use. For instance, they use a bunch of documents from unreliable news sites. So all those preconceptions and false statements in these news sites get built into the model. Wikipedians, which is one of the main data sources for these models, is written by mostly male people, okay? Only 8% are women, and so that means these models will be biased in that way. In the end, what you get is the models that make all sorts of stereotypical associations and have all sorts of problems. Luckily, there's people interested in solving these issues. For instance, in this paper, they propose a bunch of solutions, such as better data collection and better objectives. And so hopefully we'll be able to make use of these models in the most positive way. So how do these models work? Very quickly. So these are based on neural networks. So neural networks are powerful universal function approximators that can represent, in principle, any function if you give them enough parameters, okay? And in particular, in natural language processing, these models functions model objects like this, like probability of some input text, of some output text condition on some input text, or the probability of an English sentence condition on that sentence in Spanish, which is what happens when you go and use Google Translate. So you're basically using some sort of translation model that is based on this conditional distribution. Other models use just basically probabilistic language models, which is the probability distribution over sentences in Spanish and so on. So what are the basics here? And it's very general, right? Like, so imagine you have a powerful function that models some conditional distribution like this. It has parameters theta. Those are the parameters of the model. And so this input function is basically a sentence pair, input and output text. And the output of the model or of the function is this conditional probability that assigns to an output sentence condition on that input, okay? So what do we do, or what do people do in machine learning? So they have these data sets, which are basically billions of websites, Wikipedia and so on. And then they train those powerful models so that they behave like ChatGPT, right? Like they do this sort of thing. So it's basically how do they do it, right? So how are these parameters tuned? How are these variables adjusted so that these models behave the way they do? Okay, so let me tell you a little bit more about that. So basically, the simplest version of this strategy is basically maximum likelihood estimation, which is basically you fix the parameters of the model theta by asking the model to assign high probability to the sentence pairs in the training set. Okay, so you take this data sets of websites and all the text you can collect on the internet, and then you ask this model P theta of this conditional distribution, then so that you assign high probability to these pairs. Okay, so that's the simplest strategy people use, and so you can imagine that initially at the beginning, when your model has no information about the data pairs, so X and Y are those are my say sentences. And so at the beginning, it assigns homogeneous or basically constant probability to every sentence, okay, roughly. But then at the end, you train the model and you want it to look something like this, right? So you want to assign high probability to the sentences in your data set or this data pairs X, I, Y, I, where X, I, and Y are this input and output texts, okay? So that's what we would like to see. And so the maximum likelihood is, or the objective function that these models use is the log likelihood, basically the probability of these sentences under the model P theta. And then, or equivalently, the negative of the log of that probability, which is simpler to handle in the numerical procedure, and then you maximize this quantity or minimize this one. Okay, and what you do is you basically take the algorithm called gradient descent with respect to these parameters in the model, and iteratively update this parameters following the direction of the steepest descent. Okay, so that's basically how these models are trained at the simplest level. And so you initially, the probability distributions are like more or less constant in the state space of sentences. And then you start applying these iterations of the algorithm and you start assigning higher and higher probability to your sentence pairs, right? So second iteration, third, and so on and so forth, until enough iterations you get to something like this, okay? Hopefully you're successful and you're careful enough. And so now what you do is you prompt your model with some input sentence X0, explain quantum tunneling like I'm a rat in one paragraph, okay? And then you do a cut on this space, and then you see that this distribution looks like this, okay? And then you sample that that conditional distribution, and then it spits sentences, okay? And so here you have two sentences with high probability, right? Like, so one of them is, hello, rat, quantum tunneling is like when you can go through the walls of your cage, even if you don't have the energy, et cetera, okay? But then similarly, you have other sentences which have high probability, okay? So this one is quantum tunneling is when a tiny particle can go through a barrier and so on. So they both are valid sentences that have high probability under the model that you just trained, okay? So this is roughly how these models work and roughly how machine learning in general works, right? Like, it's a very generic cartoon. I just picture a very simple one, but in the context of language models, okay? So this is what they do. One more ingredient is that these language models are autoregressive. So this term autoregressive originates from the time series models, where observations from the previous time steps are used to predict the value of the current time step. And so what you do is you write down this conditional distribution over variables y, and where y is this high dimensional y1, y2, through yn condition on some x. And then very generically, you can always write this distribution in this form using the chain rule of probability. So you write it as probability of y1, always condition on x, times probability of y2, condition on x and y1, and so on and so forth. And so what you're doing is you're predicting this next word or next variable y2 condition on the previous steps that you've seen. and you follow that strategy. And so this is very general, so you can specify any conditional distribution in this form, but generically requires an exponential amount of memory. And what people do and what they have been doing in machine learning for a long time is instead of writing this as in a tabular form, they write this as a, they just parameterize the conditionals with a single function, for instance. Okay, and that alleviates this exponential complexity of the full tabular representation. All right, and so this is what machine learning people design. What are the best best parameterization of these conditional distributions? And so what they've done and what leads to all those impressive results in natural language processing is use large neural networks to parameterize these conditionals. So in language modeling, this these variables y, they can represent characters or words or generally tokens, as they call them, which are basically roughly four characters in the English language. But you can think of them as their words, okay, when you're using using these models to represent text. And so because of that autoregressive structure at the most basic level, so these models create sentences adding one word at a time. Okay, so you start from the text that you input as condition, then you sample the first word, then the second, then the third, and so on and so forth. And what you do is you keep calling this conditional many, many times. Okay, and then these models produce a reasonable continuation of whatever text it's got so far, following. So this is from this text. It's a very interesting explanation of what these models do by Stephen Wolfram. They follow what one might expect someone to write after seeing what people have written on billions of web pages, okay? Because everything is based on this website data, okay? So this is how they work. So they build this sentences and this made up stories by adding one word at a time probabilistically. So this is one example of a language model. It was the recurrent neural network. It's a little bit older from roughly when they started using it for language models in 2014, roughly, and what these models have the structure. It has an encoder that reads this input text, and it creates a high-dimensional representation of that text that you fed to the model, and then it has a decoder part that produces this output text probabilistically. Okay. So that's very generic structure all these models follow. So each of these neural networks that I drew here are precisely this conditional distribution that I was explaining these models parameterize, okay? So and here this each of this say boxes represent probability of some variable Z conditioned on the input and the words that it has seen so far at this point. So that's the structure of the models. They follow all this similar structure and encoder, high dimensional representation of the input and a decoder that produces this text. Okay. I've been talking about language modeling, but we're interested in using this for quantum states, right? Like to represent physical systems. And so first thing we do is we get rid of the encoder and set this vector to zero, okay? And the second thing that we do is in language models, we had words, right? Like we had, for instance, 8,000 words in our dictionary, and now this output or this input will be, for instance, the spin degrees of freedom in a quantum system, right? So we replace these words and characters and we replace them with, the measurement outcomes on a quantum state, okay? And so that's what I have here. So you go from a dictionary with about 8,000 words if you want to read a piece of newspaper on the BBC, and you just replace it with spin up or down or more generally with the outcomes of a generalized measurement. So I have two examples. So I'm going to tell you first about data-driven reconstruction of quantum states. So what is that? So this is basically a technique or strategy called quantum state tomography. which is the closest in spirit to what people do in machine learning. So basically what you do is you, in quantum state tomography, is you try and reconstruct the quantum state through measurements on the system. And it's the gold standard for benchmarking and verification of quantum devices. As useful for characterizing optical signals, diagnosing errors in state preparation, and for entanglement verification and more. So the problem, or like the motivation we had, was that we need to go beyond quantum state, like standard quantum state tomography, which is very expensive, computationally scales exponentially with the size of the system. Why we want to do this? Because there's a lot of progress in controlling large quantum systems and lots of availability of arbitrary measurements performed with good accuracy. And so the bottleneck in using quantum state tomography for large systems is as this curse of dimensionality of traditional quantum state tomography techniques. And these are examples of systems that are very large. So these are experiments on 256 atom programmable quantum simulator. Here I have one where I participated with 1,800 qubits and more. So how to make quantum state tomography efficient? You have to give up on the generality of quantum state tomography, and you introduce some parameterization of the quantum state that has good scaling and non-trivial structural information about the quantum state you're trying to reconstruct. So you give up on being able to reconstruct any state at the price of introducing the constraints. So people have been doing this for a while. So these are two examples, matrix product state quantum state tomography and MPO, matrix product operator quantum state tomography, and they work very well, and they have been around for a while, but they're mostly suited for one-dimensional systems, okay? And we want to explore other quantum systems in 2D and in 3D and maybe more. Another strategy is introduce a parameterization using neural networks where we kind of like participated in the development, and so we have some advantages. So they work for pure states with structure. They produce high fidelity results, but only pure states. And then there's other paper where they introduce mixed states with some structure, high fidelity, but poor scaling. So the one example that I wanted to discuss was a strategy that we introduced in this paper where we parameterize measurement statistics of informationally complete measurement and using these language models, okay? And I'm gonna try to motivate why we use language models. And so we use this idea to reconstruct quantum states using synthetic and experimental data and the example that I'm gonna present. So learning quantum states with recurrent neural networks, so language models. So first, we imagine, or if we're doing it in an experiment, we go and prepare an unknown quantum state. We apply a measurement that probes enough information about the quantum state, repeat many times, because when we measure the state, we destroy it, and we collect statistics, okay? So that's this data set. So this is why, in spirit, this is closest to machine learning. You have a data set, and you're trying to infer some reconstruction of the quantum state. And so we do this using these language models. And at the end, we create a certificate of the reconstruction, which is basically, for instance, the quantum fidelity between the reconstructions and the state that the experimentalist wanted to prepare, for instance. Okay, so that's the idea. So the measurements that we use, the experimental description of the measurements that we apply in the system is through a positive operator value measures. There are sets of operators, they're positive semi-definite, and they adapt to the identity. They basically describe the experimental measurements that you use in the lab. And the connection between the experiment and quantum theory is through Born rule that gives you the probability of some measurement outcome A. Given that you apply this measurement M on your state row that you produced in the lab. Okay, and if the measurements are so-called informationally complete, which we will try to use, then this measurement statistics PA, this distribution, contains all the information about the quantum state rule. Okay, so that's the one way of calling, or one way of describing informational completeness. pictorially, you can imagine this quantum state being a three-dimensional object. It's obviously higher dimensional, but you can imagine having a quantum state, and then you want to observe it from enough viewpoints so that you have enough information about the state to be able to say what it is. Okay, so you can imagine this object and these measurements, look at it from different angles. The other idea is that if you are measuring the state using this informationally complete measurements, that the relation between rho and p can be inverted, okay? And so this is what we've done. So we inverted this relation. So you can go, here you go from rho to p, and now here we go from p to rho. So we can infer rho from the statistics of the measurements that we've applied on the system. This can also be seen as a factorization of the quantum state in terms of a probability distribution and some tensors that we attach to the state. All the entanglement and potential complexity of the quantum state, then it's baked in P, okay, in this distribution. And with this equation, we can do all sorts of things. We can do tomography, real-time dynamics, measurements, and so on. So we've played a lot of games with this equation. Okay, so I'll show you some more examples later. The insight we had was, let's, instead of parameterizing the quantum state rho, let's parameterize this probability distribution. And now this is where we get closer to the language model. So we use a language model to represent this probability distribution, PA. Okay, and so what we do is basically we create this data set of measurements. So this is the equivalent of having all the internet text. It's just this data set with measurement outcomes. And we use, again, it's the same principle, maximum likelihood principle, which is basically assign high probability under your model to the data set that you observed in the lab. Okay? And then with that, we reconstruct the probability distribution of the measurement outcomes. And if we attach these tensors to it, the tensors are related to how you apply measurements to the state, then you recover a model for your density matrix. Okay? So that's what we did. So that's the idea, right? Like a rough idea about that. So we went ahead and we tried this on synthetic data sets for a family of GHZ states. They're states that are very common in quantum information. So this is the GHZ state. The cat state is all 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1, 1 in coherent superposition. And we also studied what happens if you add noise in the form of a local depolarization, which is basically a model of a decoherent qubit, where with probability 1 minus p, each qubit remains intact. With probability p, an error occurs. So this produces a density matrix that we would try to reconstruct. And so let me show you one example. So first, learning a very small system, so 2 qubit with local depolarization. And we try first, so this is pre-language models. So we tried an architecture called restricted Boltzmann machine, and we were successful. So this is as a function of the noise, and this is this distance or divergence between the true probability distribution given by the GZ state and the model that we're trying to train. And what we find is that as we train the model, this KL divergence goes to zero, meaning that the two distributions match, and you get a good representation of the quantum state in the end. So this is the fidelity of the distribution, which is defined as this overlap. And what we see is that as we, again, we train the model, this this overlap goes to one. And this is the quantum fidelity, which is, again, it goes to one as you train the model. And the problem what we found is that it was very difficult to scale beyond, say, 2 or 3 qubits with this restricted Boltzmann machine that we've been playing with up until that time. And so that's where I came up with the idea, let's use language models, because probably the issue is basically when you take this generalized measurements, this local Hilbert spaces are higher, and so maybe one way to address it is using this language models. And indeed, I went ahead and tried. So, and I was able to go to 40 and even 80 qubits with and without noise with high fidelity reconstructions. What we found is that the systems already go beyond the traditional quantum state tomography. And numerically, we check that for learning this particular set of states, we require only a linear number of samples with respect to the number of qubits in the system. Some key aspects about this model, which were those recurrent neural networks, is that they can represent this very high dimensional probability distributions very compactly. They have a similar behavior to matrix product states if we linearize the model, and so that matches well with the structure of the state that we were targeting. Okay, so that's the result, and we went ahead and demonstrated experimentally with only 3 qubits, which is what you can play with on this IBM machines that you can, we can all sign up for this. So we took this data set from these machines you can access online, and we perform reconstructions. As you can see here, this is the density matrix of a GHZ state with 3 qubits on one of these machines, and this is the result from traditional quantum state tomography, which is doable at this scale. It was published in this paper with friends from Cornell. Okay, so let me skip to the next example. So I've talked about the example which is closest in spirit to machine learning, which is when you have data set and then you reconstruct the model or you estimate some probability distribution. But in quantum antibody physics in general, so we're interested in also all sorts of problems like can you simulate quantum dynamics of a quantum system? Or can you compute ground states and so on? So I'm gonna give you one example or two about simulating quantum dynamics, okay? And so what we did is, again, we're gonna be using similar language models, and so we have to translate what, for instance, unitary dynamics or open quantum system dynamics looks like in this language of probability. So in some sense, what we're doing is we're making quantum physics look a little bit more like machine learning in this representation. So when you do unitary dynamics, you take an input, an initial state rho, and then you evolve it with a unitary matrix, and that gives you a unitarily evolved quantum state rho u, okay? And then if you follow this equations that I was trying when we did this inverses and so on, so then what you get is a time evolution or an evolution of the probability distribution p. So this would correspond to quantum state rho, and now this pu is the rotated or the unitarily evolved probability distribution pu. And so it's basically matrix vector multiplication if you think about this distribution that's a high dimensional vector, okay? And these matrices, of course, are related to the unitary operation that you're acting on the system U, okay? So these matrices have, so we studied them and they have a lot of interesting properties. They're almost like conditional probability. Mathematicians call them somewhat stochastic matrices or quasi-stochastic matrices, in that if you sum over the columns, you get one, like a stochastic matrices, but they can be positive or negative. And that's, again, all the quantum effects playing a role in the dynamics or in the time evolution of the system. And so we went ahead and we studied how to simulate, for instance, quantum circuits using probabilistic models, okay? And let me tell you about that story. So we have a quantum circuit. We start the quantum device in a simple state, which is a product state 0, 0, 0, 0, and then you apply some unitary gates, and at the end you measure the state, okay? And so that, in the probabilistic language, translates in taking some initial probability distribution P0 and then multiplying it by this somewhat stochastic matrices. And at the end, you get this outcome state represented as a probability distribution. Okay? So let me show you more or less how we do it very briefly. So let me apply just one gate, so one local unitary. So you have your initial distribution that's very simple. It's a product distribution because we're starting the state in a product distribution. So we can basically assume that we have efficient access to this distribution. And then we apply this somewhat stochastic matrix to it, and then we get the time evolved distribution. So we take this initial distribution, multiply by the matrix, and then we get this P. So this is very different from the traditional machine learning task that typically requires data. So there's no data. Here, the only thing we have is the prescription of the unitary matrix that we're going to apply to the quantum state. Okay, so can we still train these models even though we don't have data? And so the answer is we came up with strategy, and it's basically this one. So what we do is, again, we introduce a model P theta. And what we found is that we can compute the divergence or the distance in probability space between the time evolved distribution and the model P theta. Okay, and then if we minimize this down to zero, then that means that this P theta model represents this distribution exactly, okay? And so this is what this KL divergence looks like. If these two distributions match, then this logarithm is zero, and then you get zero, okay? So we split this into two terms. So we have this distribution here, the PU times the log of P, and then the entropy, the cross entropy between PU and P theta, and then the entropy of the time evolved distribution. And then we're gonna be using gradient descent to minimize this objective function, which is basically taking the derivative of this object with respect to theta. And so this term here and the entropy of the time evolved distribution does not contribute. And so the only thing we have to compute is this cross entropy between the time evolved distribution and your model. And what we found is that we can produce estimates of this cross entropy without having access to the probability distribution after time evolution or after unitary dynamics, okay? And so we came up with an estimator, we minimize it, and that's it, right? Like, so it's the simplest implementation we came up with. We came up with better objectives and so on, but let me just say that this as a beginning or as a simple strategy, this worked already very well. So we went ahead and we tried this. So can we simulate quantum dynamics using probability distributions and language models? So that's what happened when you apply one gate, but then we want to apply multiple gates to be able to build this quantum circuit, right? So then, so you start from some probability distribution P0, and then you target the probability distribution P1, and you try and optimize this probability distribution P theta as much as you can, but then suppose you make a little bit of an error, which you do because maybe this optimization didn't go well or didn't go to exactly zero, so you've made some little mistake, but then you still assume that there's good enough, and you target this P2 after time evolution, and then you make one more mistake, and you keep doing this on and on, and so what you see is that errors may accumulate since this optimization does, in cases where the optimization does not lead to zero KL divergence, okay? But we tried anyways, because, I mean, even though we know that this would lead to an accumulation of errors, pretty much the same thing happens in a real quantum device when you're trying to implement this gate, so we tried anyway. Okay, so here is basically producing some very simple states on two qubits. So what I'm plotting here is the KL divergence between the probability distribution before and after I train it. And what we found is that as we minimize this KL divergence, so this KL divergence goes very fast to very small. Okay, so it basically converges exponentially to a very small value, meaning that the optimization is good. But then when we apply the second one, so initially it goes exponentially fast, but then it saturates at some higher value of the error. So meaning that we see this effect of error accumulation as we perform this optimization. And you can see the same effect in the infidelities and in distance between probability distributions too, and quantum infidelity as well. So this is for a Bell state, and this is for a graph state, and we see the same effects. But ultimately, what we see is that the fidelity eventually converges to very high values. Okay, so we were happy, and then we tried bigger quantum circuits, right? Like, so we tried very, very simple quantum systems. So we simulated the GZ state and this linear graph state using these probabilistic models. And what we find is that We see this error accumulation as we grow the number of qubits, which grows the number of gates that you're applying. And so for very small circuits, the fidelity is high, but as we make the systems bigger and bigger, this fidelity drops because of this error accumulation I was talking about. So that's the story that we, even though we don't have data sets produced so that we can target this problem using data, we can still use the prescription of the quantum circuit to try and simulate the system or the quantum state after evolution. So the last example I have is we can also try and simulate real-time dynamics of open quantum systems, okay? And we follow a similar strategy, right? Like, so we tackled Lindblad evolution where you have some, like the time evolution of your density matrix is equal to a part driven by the Hamiltonian dynamics. So this is the unitary part, but then some dissipation given by this Lindbladian. Okay, and then what we do, we follow the same strategy. We apply Born rule and we think about time evolution in terms of this probability distributions, and we came up with a differential equation for this quantum state represented as a probability distribution rho. Okay, so again, so everything is reflected. So there's a part that corresponds to the unitary dynamics of the system, and one part that takes into account the dissipation of the system. And so this was published recently last year in PRL. Basically what we have to do is we have to integrate a very high dimensional differential equation, but we cannot write all the components of the differential equation. We have to replace it with a model. Okay, so that's what we do here. So how do we approximately, or how do we integrate this differential equation? So the strategy that we took is, so we took inspiration from the trapezoidal rule, okay, as that people use in basic differential equations. And we design an objective function so that if we optimize it with gradient descent, the same algorithm that I was explaining at the beginning, and if the optimization succeeds, then this trapezoidal rule is implemented exactly. And our differential equation is integrated effectively. Again, I mentioned that we don't need any data for optimizing this model. Everything is based on the knowledge we have about the model. So it's everything happens through the Hamiltonian and the form of the Lindblad dissipative operators that you have in your equation. So there's no data required, only you use the Hamiltonian and the dissipation. We can also find fixed points. So when you have an open quantum system, if you let it evolve in time, it eventually reaches a steady state. And we can also target that fixed point by basically setting dp dt equal to zero, right? Like we enforce that this probability distribution does not change in time. Okay, and that we came up again with an objective function that we can compute with this model so that we hopefully converge to the steady state of the Lindbladian that we're trying to study. And we use, again, to represent this probability distributions, language models. Let me quickly show you two examples, or very, very quickly. So we looked this is a two-dimensional Heisenberg model. It's quench dynamics, so this is a function of time in units of this amplitude of the dissipation gamma, and this is tracking the evolution of the expectation value of sigma z, some operator in the model. And what we find is that we were able to compare with exact results because it's only a 3x3 system in two dimensions. But what we see is we can track the behavior as a function of time very accurately. And this is again out of equilibrium at the say short time. But then we looked at the steady state for say 16 qubits where we can still perform exact calculations. And we computed, again, so this is for the transfer field Ising model in 1D, and we looked at the steady state, so the state after a long time of evolution. So we still compare with the exact results, and we found that our numerics matches well with the exact numbers. So this is again comparing with restricted Boltzmann machines from this PRL paper, and clearly our results are just a bit way more accurate in general when we target the steady state. We were able to go to bigger system sizes, I think bigger than what you can do with other techniques, but at that point there's no way to compare with anything, so I don't have the results here. I guess let me brag a little bit. So this is described in this paper, they describe it as the most advanced state-of-the-art results in the simulations of dissipative dynamics. So we're very proud of that. The other thing we did was we benchmarked against some classical algorithms, but also quantum algorithms designed to target steady states. And we were very happy that our results always match the exact numbers, whereas all other quantum algorithms deviate from the exact results quite significantly. So that's still an open question regarding how you define a quantum algorithm that performs well for this type of systems. Okay, so I think I have, I want to stop here so that we can have a discussion. So we've introduced two examples of applications of language models or autoregressive models in quantum many-body physics. One is about quantum state reconstruction, and the other one about simulating quantum dynamics of closed and open quantum systems. So not just my work, but all this exciting work at the intersection between machine learning and quantum physics and so on showcases the opportunities that machine learning techniques, ideas, and research cultures can spark in the field of quantum physics. I'm very excited about that. So I think it's a privileged time for quantum research due to enormous opportunities arising from AI, artificial intelligence, quantum computing, which are, in my opinion, the most promising computational paradigms. And I think this cross-fertilization is exciting and it's growing, and we should grab the opportunity and do all the work. And with that, thank you.
All right, thank you for the great talk, Juan. Are there any questions in the room or online? If they're online, you can go ahead because I can't see it.
This is just a speculative question. So despite the amazing results from ChatGPT, a lot of people in the machine learning are kind of shifting their, opinion on autoregressive models and whether they can actually capture the right things or they truly are just these stochastic parrots. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering if you have any ideas about whether that maybe also appears in these contact texts and maybe if there's something fundamentally missing from the autoregressive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they may have some limitations, right? Like, so they have this kind of like sequential nature built into them, right? So this is always there. This has this one-dimensional kind of like structure built in. We've tried, and as you know, we've tried to make them more suitable to higher dimensional systems, but if you're sampling, then you always have this path that is one dimensional that you have to follow. They may have some limiting characteristic to it that perhaps will need to be bypassed if we want to make more progress. So maybe, yes. And they're very powerful. They can represent any function in principle, but maybe there's when you put it in on a practical level, you have a relatively small set of states you can reach, and maybe this is a limitation and we'll have to go beyond this and relax and give up on the nice characteristics related to this model, which are basically two. So there's the tractability of the computation of the probability and the exact sampling that you can afford because of the structure. Those may be important in some cases, but maybe not in all cases, and so you can get rid of it and still get good results. And it's probably true. I mean, it may not work for everything, and you may have to go and explore other models with a different structure.
Hi, Wen. Thank you for your very engaging and informative talk. And I have a maybe very classical and general question. Like, as you all know, in the usual machine learning, the explainability is always a very big problem. But as you also said before, the machine learning in physics is very different from our traditional application. So is it this kind of problem going to be improved, especially when we are talking more more predictive, more well-defined physical data? Is it going to be the whole machine learning in, is it going to be less a black box?
Mm-hmm.
Is that going to happen? What's your opinion?
Yeah, so I think there's some black boxness to these models, but at the same time, you can probe a lot of aspects related to these models through everything you may want to know about the quantum state you're trying to represent. Like, for instance, you want to know how correlation functions decay. You can use them and then check the behavior. And so that's part of the explainability, right? How is the model behaving with respect to your expectations as a physicist, right? Of course, you want more, and then at that point, it becomes challenging because these models have the same issues. But I always highlight the fact that many techniques that we already use and we're comfortable with are also black boxes. Like, for instance, in some regard, tensor networks have that aspect to it, right? It's not that you go and interpret every weight in the tensor network. You basically compute correlation functions they have a lot of, and even very profound understanding about how they work and what type of state they represent. Maybe some of those aspects are perhaps not developed yet for this type of models. So I think we can go a little bit beyond what we've done, but at some point, I don't know if we will reach that level of explainability that would be satisfactory, right? I think there's some to be done, but I'm not sure where we would be able to stop, right? I don't know if I answered the question, but
cool. Thank you.
Hey, Juan. So, somehow intangible things, when you read these things coming out of ChatGPT and they sound compelling to you or logical or something a human would write, there are these intangible things that are encoded in this probability distribution that, I don't know if I could describe to you the variable of, it sounds like something a human could write. But given that that information is somehow in this probability distribution, can you pull that out? Can you define, a feature of this probability distribution that corresponds to, this looks like something that a human could write? and if you could do that, could you then, on the quantum side, be that's something that looks like quantum mechanics would do.
Yeah.
And learn something, could you use this to learn something about quantum states or some intangible thing that's, a more detailed description or correlation between many things, mm-hmm. that's sort of intangible?
Yeah, so that's very profound, but I don't think I have a good answer to that question. So I'll maybe, so everything happens through passing correlations around using these vectors that are passed around. So maybe we can look at the statistics or the statistical behavior of those vectors as you create more and more sentences. And that probably tells you a little bit about, so people in machine learning, and actually these vectors give the name to Vector Institute, right? It's this thought vectors, they call them, right? Like it's how is what this model thinks about the past sentences and the, what it has seen before. Maybe, so, and then when you do correlations in a quantum state and everything happens through what happens in these vectors. And we have some examples where we write down, so the analytical expression for some particular quantum state that's easy. And we know what these vectors behave, right? So maybe eventually we can connect the statistical behavior of these vectors as we translate or as we as we use these models to kind of like get a better understanding of what these models do, and then use that to inform what we care most about, which is this quantum state. But this is a very vague answer, so, but to a very profound question.
Second question. Do people think about how neurodiverse people learn language in very different ways to inform how you train on these natural language models? So like, I mean, for example, some people are so-called gestalt learners where they have no idea what a specific word means, but there could be a sentence that is in a movie that's like, you know, 5 or 10 words, and they perfectly understand the meaning of that. They don't learn. In other words, like to contrast with this model where you're adding word by word, there it's really about these like putting scripts together. Mm-hmm. There's a very different way that some people process language, think about language. Mm-hmm. Anyway, are there neurodiverse like machine learning algorithms?
So I don't know the answer. So the training strategy they follow, so they use either maximum likelihood or maximum likelihood plus some feedback with humans and so on. I think ultimately how they end up encoding the language is neurodiverse, because like this is so different from the brain that eventually this has to be somehow different. But I'm not aware of ML people using or understanding of neurodiverse people using that to train these models.
Mm-hmm. All right. Unless there are any other questions in the room.
Yeah, I agree with that, and it more or less agrees with the sentiment from, it's this, right? Like, so these models produce reasonable continuation or statistical continuation of what texts got so far, according to statistics of language written on the internet. Sorry, can you say the last part again? Yeah, that's right. So there's nothing, I agree. There's nothing magic about it. And it's just basically the statistics of language compressed, some people say, on the weights of these neural networks. Sorry, can you say?
Okay, so maybe I don't know much about this, but like the fact that you can like reduce what seems like a very complicated like set of like probabilities if I gave you some prose and then like what's the output going to be to something like that, that ability to condense it or compress it seems like the interesting feature of language, or I don't know if it's a feature of language or if you think it's generic and like whether quantum mechanics is supposed to be the same or like what's the, anything to say there?
Yeah, so I think so the interesting thing is you can you can definitely compress that or kind of like create a model that fits well the language such that when you say sample it and you use it, you get reasonable. Basically that the language has enough structure that you can capture it, right? And one of the reasons why we think this works also for quantum is because of similarities between the correlations in a quantum system versus a language model. And we think they're similar, right? Like, and at least in systems which are not random states in Hilbert space, but say for instance, ground states of a quantum system with local interactions, right? And we've seen examples. So we know, for instance, that the mutual information in between, say, words in a language follows a power law. And these power laws are very similar to critical behavior of, say, classical and quantum systems. So they have decaying correlations and that can be, again, captured by this model. So it's vague, but we think there's some common structure.
Can you give an example of something you think couldn't be compressed? Like, I mean, that you couldn't learn with that type of compression or?
Sorry?
Like, I guess, like, what makes, like, predicting the weather harder or something like that? Like, can you say something about the class of things that you can, like, represent the input-output in terms of these, like, simple or conditional probabilities rather than something more complicated?
Okay, so there's several answers, right? Like, so this, when we parameterize this through large neural networks, in particular the recurrent neural network that I presented here, so they can represent any function, okay? So if you give it enough parameters. So, but of course, when you use it in practice, you don't use an exponentially large representation, and so they end up having some structure. And this structure that they have fits well within the correlations of language, and that's why these models are successful. And then when we tried on quantum systems, we also found something similar, right? That these architectures are very good at describing, say, ground states of quantum many-body systems, and that seems like a coincidence, or we tried without thinking too hard about it. And it's just that they're powerful enough and flexible and apparently or seemingly contain the right structure so that when you try it on quantum systems, they actually perform really well. So I don't have a very precise answer other than examples that demonstrate that they work really well and some theoretical insights where, let me see if I have... one example of a paper where they map this recurrent neural network to a tensor network. And tensor networks we understand better, right? Like we know what type of quantum states they can represent. And I'm almost there. So that, for instance, this paper from 2019, they argue that this architecture, the recurrent neural network, can be written down as a tensor network, which has a better theoretical footing in physics, right? Like, and so they make the connection, so it tells you that maybe they're suitable for representing quantum states that can be represented also with tensor networks, which is the case, for instance, for this state where we also saw very strong results. Okay, so we don't have a full picture right now, but we're getting there, I believe, in terms of what type of quantum states you can represent and which ones you cannot. So in principle, with many parameters, all of them, but of course, when you constrain the model to something that you can handle in your computer, then you impose some structure, and the structure seems to match well both language and quantum states arising from either ground states of local Hamiltonians or their time evolution.
All right, on that note, let's call it quits. Let's thank Juan one more time for a very interesting talk.
Thank you.